welcome to CMU Booked, Carnegie Mellon's official book podcast, where we actually read
and finish the books. I'm Sam.
And I'm Hannah. And today we are discussing Emma by Jane Austen, published in the early 1800s.
I'm super hyped to talk about it. I mean, also on CMU, we have a lot going on. This week is Carnival, if you're listening to this.
Yeah.
As it's coming out. It's going to be amazing, and I'm super hyped to talk about this book.
Me too. You know, if I loved you less,
I might be able to talk about it more. Let's go.
Let's freaking do this.
Let's do this. So, media consumption of the week. What have you been watching? What have you been reading? Tell me about it.
Ooh.
You may say I'm a dreamer. Go for it.
Shout out Millie Bobby Brown.
Yup.
I have been, I just started Anna Karenina.
Right.
Which, whoo, doggy.
She thick.
Yeah, she is a thick girl, but I've been reading the preface very, intently.
Okay.
Just because it's giving me so much info about Leo Tolstoy.
Yeah.
Which, if you know me, you know I read Wikipedia pages for fun. So this is basically my dream come true. I love reading it. Did you know he studied law? Well, now you do. Anyway, that's what I've been doing. I've been watching a lot of horror movies. As Above, So Below, just watched.
Ooh.
Really good. Really good. Takes place in the Paris catacombs.
Oh,
shout out.
Yes.
La Toupe.
The mole. It means the mole.
Oh my gosh, no. Because what the fuck was he doing down there? They didn't go back for him. Anyway, so if you want to, if you want to dip your toes into some real freaky stuff, highly recommend. Very good. Pretty dark.
Yeah.
Okay. Pretty dark. A little gory.
But love it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do enjoy.
So there's one for you freaks out there.
Yeah. Sam, how about you, girl? What you been up to? What's on the docket?
Girl, I've been watching season 2 of Severance. You already know. You already know who it is. Silent Hill. Also, really wanting to read... I have a copy of Sunrise on the Reaping. Really excited to read it. Haven't gotten to yet.
Hunger Games,
the new one about Haymitch's, Hunger Games. Been talking about it for way too long. You're not going to hear the end of it. And I'm really excited to finally dive into it.
Yeah. I've been seeing a lot of really good memes of, me at the red carpet of
and it's Sunrise pajamas. On the Reaping.
Yes. And it's just, Haymitch in pajamas. It's Woody Harrelson from the movies.
So iconic.
But that's cool. You'll have to tell me how it is.
Yeah. And... I mean, you're borrowing my copy. I'm making you read it. We're going to get Hannah into some YA, so come on, we can do this.
You do not have to pull my leg for the Hunger Games. I loved the Hunger Games. Wait, hold on. And this is, I just need to know, PETA or Gail?
Oh, PETA.
Okay, thank
Do you
God.
Think I'm crazy?
Thank God.
Do you think I'm actually crazy?
I grew up in a Gail apologist household.
That's messed up.
Isn't that horrible,
it's
girl?
It's just because of Liam Hemsworth.
I know, it's just because of Liam Hemsworth.
He's not even in the books, girl. Come on.
I know. I love you, real or not real. Fuck you.
Oh, my God, I'm banging my head against a brick wall.
That changed
me.
12-year-old my life. I was like, this is love.
12-year-olds everywhere said, no, what?
No, speaking of love.
Oh.
Let's freaking talk about some matchmaking.
Let's do it.
Matchmaker, make me a match. Shout out Fiddler on the Roof.
Let's do it. Tell me about your experience with Jane Austen.
I guess this is the third or fourth Jane Austen I've read.
Okay.
I've read Pride and Prejudice.
Love.
I mean, I had to read that in high school, but I've read Sense and Sensibility. Mm. I've read, what's the other one? What's it called? Persuasion.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Let's do it.
Read Persuasion, and I gotta say, this one takes the cake. This is my favorite.
Okay, well, I'm glad I got to this one. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, I liked Persuasion fine. Really, I mean, I enjoyed Pride and Prejudice. I definitely think that this is a better work.
Mm.
Definitely more evolved. Also, way longer.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's basically, that's my intro to the Jane Austen sect. But in high school, my English teacher, Miss Hadsall, was the biggest Jane Austen fan, the teacher
yep.
did the voices, she was full into it, but she did also educate us a lot on, like, Jane Austen as an individual. Mm-hmm. Like, she went to a museum of where Jane Austen used to live in England. Wow. And, like, took a video of the whole thing and, like, brought it to class. She had us dress up as Pride and Prejudice and Jane Eyre characters for tea party.
You were St. Jane Eyre's cousin.
I was St. Jane.
Shout out. That's crazy. Out of all the characters.
She made me the minister. And she put me at the head of the table.
What are we doing?
I walked in and I was just like, you gotta be kidding me. I was like, you have got to be kidding me.
I'm 16. I'm dressed
I'm about to go to college and you have me dressing up as St. John.
Of everyone? Not even.
She couldn't make me a girl.
The bitch who dies at the very beginning. Give me her. Let me be Helen.
Yes, Helen. Shout out Helen Burns. Yo. Shout out Helen Burns.
Love her, by the way.
She great character.
Yes. Yeah, I honestly loved her.
How about you, though? Tell me about you and Jane Austen.
So I've read Pride and Prejudice somewhat recently. I feel like I, like, hallucinated and, like, forgot the second half. But maybe that's just a product of Pride and Prejudice. But
basically, the same thing keeps happening the whole time, right? I mean,
yeah.
Kind of like Emma.
Yeah, and so, like, it's gonna end. You know how it's gonna end. And yeah. I liked Pride and Prejudice. I liked Emma way more.
Oh, okay.
So period. I'm hyped to be talking about it. Yeah. But I definitely see, like, the similarities. Like, it's in a sense, I'm like, yeah, I know what I'm getting myself into.
Yeah.
If you've read one Jane Austen book, not that you, if you've read one, you've read them all, but, like, you know the vibe.
No, it's very much, well, it's such a product of its time. Yeah. It's also such a product of its class, right? Mm. I mean, like, she is telling these stories of, you know, like, the genteel of 1813 English society. It's like, yeah, they do a lot of the same boring shit, which is writing letters. Writing letters. God, what an eye-opener. Never have I ever read a book where I've been like, holy crap, letters were such a big deal. Like, reading letters from other people to other people was like the hot freaking goss.
No, genuinely, because I had no idea. I was like, this is literally my, like, they're sexting through, like, you know, through letters. And I'm like, what are we actually doing, by the way? But I low-key love it. Yeah. No, I had no idea. There's a lot of, like, monotony in what they're doing, and I was not necessarily prepared for that before reading, like, Pride and Prejudice. But then once you get that, like, that's what these high class women are doing and this is the problems that they're having in everyday life, you gotta learn to accept that and take it for what it is.
You gotta take what you're being given and run with it. And I do you know what, in I guess we can start there with, like, monotony and it being very sort of feeling repetitive when you read old texts like this. Mm-mm. And particularly Jane Austen, I would say.
Totally.
That's sort of just like, I feel like that monotony lends itself to these characters more. Particularly Mr. Woodhouse, shout out my favorite character.
Woo!
I love Mr. Woodhouse. Yep. And I feel like when you're reading something like Pride and Prejudice and you're like, God, you know, Elizabeth, that's her name? That's the main character of Pride and Prejudice?
Oh, Elizabeth, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Lizzie Bennet, of course. Yeah. She's such a strong character that you're sort of like, God, why do you put up with all of this? Yeah. You know what I mean? And then you see her family and you see that. But I feel like the long expanses of dialogue that go on for pages and pages of people just being like, and he was very amiable and, you know, this
and
that.
He's respectable, like, and somewhat reserved. And
exactly. It's like, no, and a character specifically with Mr. Woodhouse, who's so nervous and like a hypochondriac and stuff like that. And then you have his daughter, who's the same, Isabella, not Emma. Mm-hmm. And you have people like who she insults. Mrs. Bates. Miss Bates.
She hates that bitch.
I know. Miss Bates, though, I would crack up halfway through a page. Oh. I felt less like I was having to, like, you know, trudge through paragraph after paragraph of dialogue. Whereas I'm just sort of, again, I'm on the ride with sort of Emma experiencing these characters in her life.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I have a weird thing with the dialogue. So for me, when I read dialogue, I have a hard time if they don't put, like, a, like, he said this, like, they put, if they don't put the name, I lose track of who's saying what. Mm. And it is so easy to lose track of who is saying what about who in this book. But for me, I almost felt like a lot of the times it didn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It's like when you're reading these books that have a lot of, like, you know, complicated language and all of these, like, characters that you're getting introduced to interacting, like, you're getting a sense for the world. And this, like, Emma does a great job of world building. And you're just, like, you're reading for the vibe, in a sense. Almost the same as, like, a detective novel, like The Big Sleep, which we've talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Where you're just reading for, like, the aesthetic of, like, this entire world and just immersing yourself in it. I almost felt like I was okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you think these sort of, like, male and, I guess, more male characters, how do you feel that, like, Emma sort of, like, it differentiates itself or doesn't with sort of even Jane Austen, but other sort of, I guess, like, period romances or within that sort of vein, or even Jane Eyre, something like that? Like, how do you think her portrayal of, like, Mr. Knightley, Mr. Woodhouse, Mr. Elton, they're so quirky. Her characters are so quirky in a way that doesn't overly complicate them, you know?
Yeah.
We're getting things at face value, but I'm just sort of interested. We're talking about dialogue and stuff like that. Just how you, what you perceived.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on that. I found myself actually, like, kind of comparing Emma a lot to Jane Eyre. In the sense that Jane Eyre is often referenced, at least in, like, the literary world, as being, like, one of the greatest female, like, heroines in literary fiction.
Yeah.
Which I think is great, and she is a really strong character. Emma is a strong character in a much different way, and she almost, like, technically she does have this sense where she's more of, like, a modern woman, in quotations, where she's like, I don't want to get married. At the beginning, which I'm reading, and I'm like, yo, that's actually, like, for reading this in 2025, like, that's pretty cool that was what she wants to do. And then by the end of the book, she does end up with Mr. Knightley.
Yeah.
And I don't think that takes anything away from her strength.
Mr. Knightley moves into Hartfield.
Yeah. I think that's awesome. I think it's very progressive for the time. Not to hit you with the, like, for the time. Yeah. But I think that, like, there was somewhat of a talk at one point that I actually, like, wrote down, where they describe kind of the difference between men and women
in this
book, which I think is some of the most interesting things to talk about. There's one quote that says, the ladies here probably exchanged looks, which meant men never know when things are dirty or not, and the gentlemen perhaps thought each to himself, women will have their little nonsenses and needless cares, which was kind of just thrown in there. Like, it's not talked about a whole lot, these kind of extreme differences between men and women, but it's just, like, little things that set them apart like that, where they're just, like, you're just thinking differently.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of differentiation is, like, completely understandable, because that's not necessarily what the story's about.
Have you read A Jury of Her Peers?
No,
it's
I haven't.
It's by Susan Gladwell, and it's basically, or Glasspell.
Okay.
I'm so sorry, Susan Glasspell. She's dead.
But shout out.
But she wrote, like, a frontier sort of narrative. It was also a play. Which I can't remember what it's called. But basically, it's about this woman who kills her abusive husband. And it's based on a real thing. Based on this real law case that happened. But basically, this woman kills her husband, and the whole community goes over, and all of the men are trying to look for evidence to incriminate this woman, while the sort of, like, the wives of these, you know, farmers that go to the farmhouse where this is taking place see the house and are looking at how the kitchen is, like, falling apart, the land is falling apart, the man hasn't provided anything to help the woman make it a home, and the women are very upset about this. And then they find that he killed this bird of hers, and that, like, that was the catalyst for her being like, I need to escape my abusive husband, and killing him. And it's basically just all about the entire play just sort of outlines how the men are so preoccupied with going upstairs where the murder took place and not looking at any of the actual scene, you know, not taking in the little things that lend itself to evidence and to show you that this, you know, this woman really did, but they hide the evidence because they're like, because like she's
she's
been abused, so like a battered woman syndrome is a real thing in law, and that is a justifier. But I did that line where like the ladies have their little nonsenses. It's like, yeah, you think everything is so nonsensical until it's something, you know, they think matchmaking and that sort of stuff, the little things that Emma does, just a hobby or whatever. Girl, what? She is literally like, it's like, she's like breeding, you know, like this community. Like she is sort of like they talk about, she's, no one has more authority in this community than the Woodhouses. And yeah, it's definitely something to be said that she is sort of the head of their home and their family. And yeah, at the end, I think it's also a big thing that at the end when her and Mr. Knightley, you know, get together.
Yeah.
They both admit wrongdoing. I mean, like, she has been callous to Miss Bates and played with the love lives of Harriet and Mr. Martin too freely. Mm-hmm. She didn't know the Martins and made generalizations. And he also admits that he was in the wrong with making generalizations about Harriet and her being just like a silly girl. It's like actually being smart and well-mannered and, you know, friendly and pretty gets you pretty damn far.
Yeah.
And like, you're not just any other pick of the litter. Like women should be considered that, you know, this should be considered as, you know, indicative of their good character and good breeding.
Period.
As Jane Austen would say.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely agree. She sort of spins that around. But I'm more so asking about like the male characters. Like they're like what did you think of like Mr. Elton?
Like I found it very interesting to see it all from Emma's perspective because I do think her I mean, it's not necessarily from her perspective, but we see a lot based on what she's saying and her dialogue about and how her dialogue changes when she knows these characters more. But I also see it like Mr. Elton, he pissed me off. He was pissing me off.
Yeah.
And that might be a product also of me not having seen how he's characterized in like films and stuff like that. But in the book itself, I'm rooting for Emma and I want her to be right about all of these assumptions she's making about people. But I think that part of the book is that by the end, she's realizing that she can't play everyone like a puppet master, even though that's where she finds her power in this world, which is like you were saying. I mean, she's a woman in this high class society and she can't necessarily like go out and do something that in the modern day we would see as like really like feminist and powerful. But I think that for the time, like she is doing something that like she's doing what she has power over in this specific society. The thing about her also that I want to say in her relation to men that I think is really interesting is that she knows exactly what to say and when to talk and when not to talk, except for when she slips up like a few times with Frank Churchill, like on their little trip, she gets a little too flirty. But I do think that she's taking the power into her own hands of speech, and that's what made the dialogue really interesting to
Definitely.
Me a lot. Yeah.
She's very mechanical when it comes to that stuff. She's very, well, she's so perceptive and she's so, I don't know, she's so knowledgeable of her own rank and also her like power and authority over this community that, yeah, she, you know, I think it's more of a thing of like, is that what she really wants? Is that, you know, how long can it go on for before it starts hurting the people that she does really care about? I mean, it's just like it's a coming of age story in like a few ways of like, she's, you know, she's growing and like, we see her go from so manipulative. I mean, when she says to, Harriet,
so many things that she says to Harriet, first of all.
Yeah. I give you this caution now because I shall never speak to you again on the subject. I'm determined against all interference. I call bullshit.
Yeah.
That is just not the case, you know? And I think we really see her, from a dialogue standpoint, going from saying, you know, covertly suggesting things without explicitly saying them to explicitly saying them. Like with Mr. Knightley. I just feel like we see that transformation a lot. She's a little more blunt, a little more like her dad in some ways, I think, which makes sense. I mean, she's the head of her family, has been since she was 12, I think the first chapter says. And speaking of the first chapter,
do tell.
What an opening line. Such a good opening line. I mean, and let me just, I'm just going to do a little cheeky
dramatic reading
for us. Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich, with a comfortable home and happy disposition, seemed to unite some of the best blessings of existence and had lived nearly 21 years in the world with very little to distress or vex her. Wow.
Wow.
World ended. Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich. I have never read a book where they just tell you. Literally, the only other character that I can name in my head is like Jane Bennett, where they're just like, she is beautiful and good-hearted and this.
Exactly.
But she's not clever. Jane, you know, Jane is not clever. Emma is, oh, she's clever and she's rich and she's got nothing to worry her. She's got nothing to worry her. She is such, like, this is such a protagonist. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is a book about and for the Emma Woodhouse. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It really just sets you in this world so immediately. And it's so quippy too, which I really enjoy.
I also loved that. Wait, continue.
No. Give it to me.
I loved the opening line. I also want to say that I think the opening line sets it up so well because they say like nothing vexes her as of now. And we go on to see that like she wants something to do. Basically, like she's pulling the strings on all of these people, not because like she is a manipulative person. She is manipulative, but not because she
aren't we all?
Yeah, exactly. But she wants something to do. Like she wants to improve people's lives. In a sense, she's doing it out of like the kindness of her heart. She thinks that she's doing right upon Harriet.
I wouldn't go as to, and by the end, sure. But by the beginning, it's all just a little game. And I think saying handsome at the beginning, okay, first of all, like, I don't think we hear, like women were called handsome back then for sure, but it gives her a sense of authority. And it's also like, she's beautiful, but like, that is not what she is. Like she is rich in a lot of ways, but she is, you know, she has a lot to give her pleasure in her life. You know what I'm saying? She has nothing that's vexing her. She has nothing to give her grief during the day-to-day things. And I think we also get an extreme sense of boredom.
Yeah. So she has to come up with something to do, which is why the rest of the book happens.
People, their stories, their things that are happening in their lives. I believe, Dylan said, she, you know, is she a people collector or a story collector or is she a gossip? It's sort of all of them to a certain extent, right?
Yeah.
Less so story collector, I think, just because she reframes them in other ways when she then relays them to other people. But I do think she is a people collector. We see that with Harriet. We saw that with, what is it, Miss Taylor?
Yeah.
Oh, Miss Taylor. Oh, poor Miss Taylor. Yeah. I love that line. I started highlighting it just because I thought it was so funny. Oh, poor Miss Taylor.
But
what a tragic thing to happen. Like, she's happily married, bro.
Yeah, like, she's absolutely chilling. Like, it's not that deep. But I completely understand. She doesn't want these, like, at the beginning, I think she's very resistant to change. Especially because she's like, I don't want to get married. I want to stay in the house with my dad.
No.
Like, she doesn't want, she's happy doing what she's doing. But also, when she meets Harriet, like, she just wants to put Harriet in a jar and keep her next to her all the time and make her perfect, like Emma Woodhouse is. Which is completely understandable from, like, a teenage girl perspective. Is, like, when you become infatuated with the idea of having this friend who's, like, perfect. Like, she's like, this is going to be, like, my project, essentially, to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's, like, relatable. But maybe I'm just crazy.
You're not crazy.
Clueless.
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing that I wanted to say is that the one character who always reminds me that this is Clueless is Mr. Elton.
Yeah.
Because Elton in Clueless, like, you know, like, tries to sexually assault Cher when they're in that car.
Yeah.
And then she's like, she like ruins her dress because she like lies down and gets robbed. That movie is actually really funny. I'm like remembering a lot right now. But
he's like, get on the ground, and she's like, but it's vintage, like, yeah, Versace.
She's like, no, you don't understand. And he's like, it's an Awada.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Classic.
But it like, she's clueless. She doesn't care. She doesn't need to be. If you're rich and you're beautiful and it's 1813 and everyone respects you and you know your own power, I feel like a lot of female characters are passive in that way. Even in Persuasion, the protagonist is sort of like, doesn't really know her true worth. And on this first page, we see the real evils indeed of Emma's situation were the power of having rather too much her own way and a disposition to think a little too well of herself. And it's not physically, it's emotionally. I think it's this, she has like this sort of, you know, emotional one-up, which is what Mr. Knightley says, I think your vanity lies elsewhere from your looks. Right. I think it's inside of you. I think you truly think yourself to be the ringleader of this community of people and their lives, which isn't right.
Exactly.
You know? But she doesn't care about that.
And she looks down upon people who aren't exactly like her. But I also think that she would not like if everyone was exactly like her, because then she doesn't get to be the sole ringleader.
Yeah.
Which I think you're completely right.
I think also that it was like, was it Miss Taylor was like a mother figure to her. It's like a little short, you know, nothing a little short of like a mother to her. It's like, I struggle with that. It's like, I struggle with that, I guess. I don't know. I don't believe that. Like, I know that they're close and that, like, she doesn't want Miss Taylor to leave and she's become a staple of this household. But Emma has authority over her, too.
Yeah.
It's like, Emma doesn't really have to step to anybody, and she knows how to play her father. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's the youngest sibling. She's had, like, a lot of people to look after her at a lot of different points in her life. Mm-hmm. So I kind of get where you're coming from. I don't think she's, like, lacking in that department.
Yeah.
I think that she's completely fine. It's just that she doesn't want other people. She doesn't really want people bossing her around. So I can see where you're coming from, where you're like, I don't think she needs a mother figure. I think she just needs, like, friends that she can rely upon.
Well, I think that's what she's just been accustomed to.
Yeah.
I think that's just what she's been accustomed to. And so she just doesn't, I don't know. I feel like that absence is supposed to be felt within this growth.
Yeah.
Of like, and maybe that's just me like projecting onto this, being like, your mom does this for you. And so like when somebody doesn't have a mom, they don't have this. Like, I think that's a gross exaggeration of things.
Yeah.
But I think her cold nature at times, and sort of inability to sympathize with these people isn't helped by the fact that her dad is like a shut-in and she has no mom. You know, I don't think that it's helped by that. And also, just when mothers are such a huge figure in other, and like the family unit is so central to all of these stories. Like, again, like in Pride and Prejudice, like, what do we have without Miss Bennet being like, oh, you know, my disposition, I'm so nervous. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's a whole thing. And like the whole part of when her sister runs off with the soldier and, you know, it's all being, they all have to stop it because of their reputation is at stake and the mom is going crazy and all this stuff. It's like, yeah, the Woodhouses don't really have anything at stake. Even when she's rude to Miss Miss Bates, it's not like anyone says boo about it. And that's the thing, where in the movie they make it a bigger deal. I always thought that it was going to be a bigger deal in the book.
Oh.
But really, Mr. Knightley just like pulls her aside and is like, that you did very poorly. Badly done, Emma.
Yeah.
Done, Emma. God, this book has banger lines.
Yeah. No, that's so true. I almost disagree, though. I haven't seen the movie, so I could be wrong, and they're probably making it a bigger deal. But in the book, I felt it, like, very deeply when Mr. Knightley pulls her aside and says, like, you fucked up.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying in the larger group, like, there isn't a pause. Like, we don't get, like, an awkward silence. We don't even get a piece of text that says, and people started looking around. They just jump to the next line.
Oh, okay.
And then on the next page, he scolds her. I agree. That is, no, that's significant.
I was, like, devastated when he pulls her aside, and then she's crying on the way home, because we've all done that, where she had no idea she was, like, going too far. Really, she was just like having a good time.
And also, there's something to be said that Miss Bates doesn't stop at two foolish things to say. She keeps going. There is a truth in that, but the authority in her position is that you can't be, you know, superfluous with those sorts of comments.
Yeah.
You know, you got to think about them. It means a little bit more to hear you say that than it means to hear, you know, Mrs. Bates' mom say it to her.
Exactly. And I think that's why. If I can talk about Jane Fairfax, she hates that fucking bitch so much.
Yeah.
She hates her. But I think
But wouldn't you dislike her if your mom wanted to set you up with a friend on a play date for your whole life?
Yeah.
Like, you need to be best friends. Exactly. I'd be like, hell no.
I don't like her.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
But I think that Jane and Emma are very, very similar.
Oh,
and they
yeah.
know that. But the thing is that Jane has an up on Emma in the fact that she is reserved, as they say. She wouldn't have made that comment to Miss Bates because she's not saying anything, you know? But also, one cannot love a reserved person.
That's what I was about to say. The book the book totally goes against her for being reserved, because that goes back to what we were saying about Harriet.
Yeah.
Right? She's good-humored. She can talk, you know, she knows when to speak, when not to speak. Those sorts of things. It's like Jane Fairfax needs to speak the fuck up sometimes.
Exactly.
Like, and she doesn't. And also sometimes the whole Frank Churchill and Jane Fairfax debacle.
Speak on it.
So poorly done. So poorly done. And honestly, I was as frustrated with Mr. Knightley by the end, with Frank Churchill, because I understand why, but they are mean.
Mm-hmm.
They are mean to her with the Mr. Dixon, the Dixon like sheet of paper.
She plays that little game with her. She is egging her on.
No, like, and that's, and Frank Churchill does that to Jane. And it's like, I just don't think that, you know, I don't know. I just think that I agree with you. The book does not commend Jane for being reserved or otherwise unfriendly, because your worth in this society is being friendly and smiling and amiable, and you can get along with everyone, you know? And that's why people are more apt to talk to Mrs. Elton.
Mm-hmm.
What a freaking nuisance. Mrs. Elton with her big hats.
Augusta Hawkins.
Oh my God. Oh, there we go. Name drop her.
Yeah.
Name
first
drop
and last.
Her. Yes. She won't shut the hell up, and it's more of a negative, you know, but people are more apt to talk to her and think her friendly than Jane Fairfax.
Because all you can say about Jane Fairfax is that she's not disagreeable. I think, and because she's not saying anything of value ever.
Yeah.
And so you can't get an opinion on her. So,
and plays that pianoforte.
Yeah. What do you think about Frank Churchill? Why does he pick Jane Fairfax? Is it because she has nothing that you can say wrong about her ever?
Oh,
why?
Man. No, he wants the one thing he can't get, right? I mean, that's what I think. That's what I thought when we were, when I, every single time I encounter this story and we run into that sort of triangle hexagon of love, I suppose.
Sure.
And it's about, when it gets to the point where we find out that, you know, Jane Fairfax has this governess situation set up, which she then abandons because Frank Churchill marries her and they, you know, elope, I think, after his aunt dies. And it's like his aunt would never have agreed to this in the first place. We don't see him show any kindness to her. We only see him give her a present, which then embarrasses her and ostracizes her in the view of the community. Only serves to, you know, more gossip ensues. I think it was more of like the one thing that he couldn't get. She's pretty, she's talented, and they met, you know, before this story began. And I think it, you know, it would be very easy for him to look at this situation reasonably, as Mr. Knightley repeatedly says, and says, spare yourself and Jane the embarrassment. But he doesn't. He doesn't. And instead, she walks home crying from Mr. Knightley's estate, running away because she's so upset at the situation she's been put in. She's made herself sick. Yeah. What did you think of? I want to hear your take. Why do you think he chose Jane Fairfax?
Why did he choose Jane Fairfax? I mean, to me, Frank Churchill is like, just like the worst kind of guy. I mean, he was my least favorite character in this entire series. He was my least favorite character. He pissed me right off. And I can totally see this. I see this in like the perspective of today. If I were to see these two people walking down the street, it would make total sense to me, because Frank is picking the person who won't disagree with him. It's like an easy pick to him, is what I think. If he were to choose Emma, Emma would not take his like BS all the time.
Yeah,
you know,
of course not.
Emma would not have put herself, not that Jane was putting herself in this situation, but Emma would not have put herself in any sort of situation where she has to like hide all of these things that Frank is doing and allow him to flirt with other women.
Exactly.
She would not have put up with that.
Exactly.
So Frank is choosing the person that's going to allow him to continue the lifestyle he's already living.
Dude, 100%. Yeah. And this book really like gives you such a sense of, I guess when I was reading it, I was just so like, oh my gosh, these are just like so the types of guys that you run into when
exactly.
you're dating.
Exactly.
Especially like Mr. Elton, I think I just said, he has too much real feeling to address any woman on the hazard of selfish passion. It's like, and he's always just complimenting women. Mm-hmm. He's always like, oh, it's beautiful, when he frames her picture and he's like, oh, you have such a gift. That is a really funny scene in the movie where her drawings are like, fine, and like her dad's standing right there, and they're and he's like, it's beautiful,
and it's like, whatever,
the heavens above, we must frame it. And he gets this insane frame that's a music box.
Wow.
And then they open up the painting and it's like, yeah. And I think Mr. Knightley has a line, he says it in the book too, you've made her too tall.
I remember
the only
that
thing he says.
Iconic. And he's like, no, it's because she's sitting. The proportions are perfect.
Yeah.
And,
it's like, of course the, you know, of course our beau by the end is like the dark hero, sort of cynic, who's the same as Emma.
The quiet guy in the corner, yeah. Who's been there the whole time.
Yeah, but like Frank Churchill is such a like love bomb vibes.
I was love just bomb vibes. Say that.
Like I just know in my heart he love bombed Jane Fairfax, and then just like has been stringing her along here. I've just been like, no, until I get my estate, then we'll be together. And I feel like Mr. Elton is also just like the, you know, he's gonna blow smoke up your ass so that you'll sleep with him.
Yep.
And then never call you back.
Exactly. But tell me your opinions on Mr. Knightley. I need to hear them.
Well,
so
I need
badly.
Him in my draws. So
expeditiously.
Sorry. I'm sorry, guys. Since I was a youngin',
oh,
Mr. Knightley is the man of my dreams. Also, you know, I got a thing for blondes. I do like my blondes, yeah. And Mr. Knightley is a blonde knight in shining armor. I do love him. And I like that he goes on a journey of growth the same way that she does, like I said at the beginning. It's also just like, yes, tell me how hard it is to tell me that you love me, because you love me so much.
Because
you love me so much.
I
sorry, those are the
him.
Two moans I'm allowed for this show, and they are stuck exclusively for Mr. Knightley discourse.
And I
how about
I
you what do you
that?
Think what do you think
I
give
love
me
him.
Give me your lesbian take.
Hey, I love him. Can we have like a specific part of each episode that's just the lesbian take?
Well,
it's 50% of every
right
episode
now. Let's do it. Put it in the books.
The lesbian take. So the lesbian take is that Mr. Knightley is freaking awesome. He was there the whole time, just like doing his thing.
I know.
And I was like, he's just in the background to make like stupid comments. Like he'll just be there, be like, that's stupid. And
oh,
I'm like,
yeah.
I love that kind of guy.
Oh,
in person,
yeah.
If he was a real person, I would be so annoyed with him. And Emma is, which I think is great. She is annoyed with him left and right, which is exactly how it's supposed to be.
Okay, me and my man. Okay, literally me like, and
yeah.
my man. I'm sorry. Where's
yeah.
the... You know that they... You know that the passion is there.
Yeah. When
you know that the passion
when you,
is there.
It's not even... I don't know if people are putting it this way, but enemies to lovers, it's not enemies to lovers. It's just like slight annoyance to extreme passionate love.
They just, which they I know think each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're family, yeah. Sort of, you know, not blood related. Yeah. Not blood related. But yeah, they're comfortable with one another. And that sense of familiarity is like, oh, it's just Emma needs someone that's like-minded. And I think I think Mr. Knightley is so selfish. He is so hasty in making Mr. Martin propose to Harriet.
Yep.
That letter was not long. It should have been longer. A marriage proposal should be longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mr. Knightley does he blames a lot on Emma for that going wrong, the initial proposal for Mr. Martin to Harriet. When I'm reading this, I am like, how is it that she just started hanging out with Harriet? You have a conversation, say, I think it's a bad idea to Miss Taylor. And then the next day, you're trying to cart Harriet off to be his wife. Martin, it lives on Mr. Knightley's land.
Yeah.
He pays Mr. Knightley to... he doesn't pay Mr. Knightley. Mr. Knightley pays him to do his work on the farm. It's like, I just don't believe. And then he yells at Emma for saying, you messed this up. And Emma says... oh, there's no way Mr. Martin wrote this. He must have had help.
Yeah.
Mr. Knightley definitely helped. And I think that the two of them, in their own ideas of what they think is right, make those mistakes. And by the end, they're both changed, you know,
exactly.
By one another. I think it's that sort of, it's more of a relationship than a lot of the relationships we see.
Exactly. And I think that at this time,
totally.
But at this time, like, a lot of the relationships weren't, I think, like, a lot of the relationships were the Harriet's and Mr. Martin's, where it's just like, that is the next thing to do. But so much had to be accomplished in order for Emma and Mr. Knightley to see each other as more than just friends, which I think is what made it so beautiful to me, mm-hmm. is that they... like, at the beginning, you almost don't see anything. And I think that the writing is a testament to that, is that I was like, I didn't see it necessarily until like halfway through the book. And I was like, wait, they're going to end up together, mm-hmm. which is something that you realize. And then that's what makes reading it so,
so good.
So you just like rejuvenating. I was rejuvenated by this entire plot line. There are so many different relationships that work as metaphors for each other, if that makes sense, because Harriet is to Martin as Emma is to Mr. Knightley, in the sense that they are, like, Emma is the superior to Harriet, and Mr. Knightley is the superior to Martin. They're both kind of, like, pulling the strings on each other on these relationships.
Yeah.
And I think that that is a really interesting situation. And you can see Emma and Mr. Knightley's relationship developed through the relationship of Harriet and Mr. Martin, which I think is just interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
And I really enjoyed that. And that's why I think the relationship was so complicated and like out in the ether for like 99% of the book, which makes it, when they get together, so much more like exciting.
You get that male torment.
Yes.
You get that male torment.
Absolutely.
In that relationship. It's like, that's exactly what I want to see. And this is, again, just to reference the movie super briefly, it does this again with Mr. Knightley. There's one insert scene in this is the 2020 Emma by Autumn de Wilde, directed by Autumn de Wilde. And there's one cut scene of Mr. Knightley after seeing Frank Churchill and Emma flirt and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He runs home to his estate, and it's all empty because he lives by himself, and he like strips, he like takes off all of the layers because he's got so many layers, and then he like, you know, ruffles out his tie, and then he just lies down in the middle of like this huge ballroom with all of these paintings around them because he is so distraught over this love affair. Oh my God.
Give me
that. And that's the other thing, this book, they don't dance. They dance with gloves on. In the movie, be wary, they do dance and hold hands.
What?
Jaw drop.
Whoa!
I know. That is the sex insert. You know how, like, in the 1930s, they couldn't put, like, sex in movies? And so they would, like, just close blinds, and it would be, like, an innuendo
and it would
for
have,
sex.
Like, music playing, and you're like, oh, okay.
It's just dancing.
Yeah.
It's just dancing. Oh. It's just dancing. They held hands without gloves.
Good to know.
Yeah.
But them dancing together, especially also when Mr. Knightley dances with Harriet.
No, because he's... Girl... Nice guys don't finish last.
Yeah, that's a nice guy.
Oh, he's sexy.
He had to pick up the pieces that, who was it, Frank Churchill was, oh my was God. Setting down? Dude. Or was it Mr. Elton?
Mr. Elton.
It was Mr. Elton.
Mr. Elton, but also she just totally, Emma fumbled with that.
All of the men that are absolutely fumbling. People are fumbling left and right.
Yeah. Ugh, she's so dumb sometimes, Emma. That silly girl. When Elton is just like laying it on so thick with her.
And she's like.
She's like, it's for him.
It's
and Knightley's
spoiler
like,
alert.
No, not it's not. Harriet. We referenced this line. I mean, the famous line at the beginning of our little pod episode here today. But I just want to look at it a little more because it's so fire. And have you read any love confession better than this? Sans Joe and Lori? I doubt it. Except that one's sad.
If you're going to have a love confession in any sort of media, you have to go back to the roots and you have to read this. And then you're just going to not make it as good as this, but this is the top, the pick of the litter.
Yes, give it to me.
I cannot make speeches, Emma, he soon resumed. And in a tone of such sincere, decided, intelligible tenderness as was tolerably convincing. If I loved you less, I might be able to talk about it more. But you know what I am. You hear nothing but truth from me. I have blamed you and lectured you, and you have borne it as no other woman in England would have borne it. Bear it with the truths I would tell you now, dearest Emma, as well as you have borne with them. We'll stop there. But come on.
And this is after he says, this is, and I always think of it more connected than it is. He says, she says, you speak as if you envied him being Frank Churchill.
Right.
He said, and I do envy him, Emma, in one respect. He is the object of my envy. Like, girl, oh my God.
It's just like the thing about this book is that it's so beautiful.
I'm gonna pass away.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so beautiful. And like, this feels so real because the feeling of like, I have to tell you how I feel. Mm-hmm. I have to. I literally cannot go on like this any longer. Like, seeing you is painful because you don't know that I love you. I was just thinking of it as like telling someone that you're in love with them isn't... I always think of it as something for the person who's saying it. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, I'm saying it for me. Yeah, it's a release. Yeah. I'm saying it, it's like a gift, you know? It's not, but like, not like a, you need to say thank you for a gift. It's just like, this is something that I want you to have, that I want you to know, because I feel it so greatly. And I feel like you really get a sense of it. And you have all of these very kitschy characters, all of these very male, we have the love bomber, we have the, you know, the lady obsessed one, we have all of these, you know, with the hypochondriac. Then we really have just like someone who, you resonate with, no matter if you're a man or a woman or anything, or, you know, like, it doesn't matter. It's like everyone can understand feeling that passion and love within them to a point where they just have to let it out. Gosh, it's so it's so good.
It's so beautiful.
And did a beautiful job reading it.
Thank you. I mean, I love reading from Mr. Knightley's perspective because I think that the audience in a large sense is from Mr. Knightley's perspective as you watch Emma grow and you become kind of infatuated with her in the same way that Mr. Knightley obviously has throughout this entire novel.
Of course.
Which I think is just so beautiful. I think it's great that we have that perspective.
Yeah, and it's also like, what a great book to give us just like a complex freaking character.
Yeah.
She makes mistakes. She does semi-evil things. And do you know what? We think she's a baddie for her by the end. She's literally just a girl, not to say that, like, but like, she's, you know, she's trying her best. She's 21.
Yeah.
Like,
give her a break. Thank you so much for listening, guys. For our CMU question of the week, I want to ask you, Hannah, what is your favorite part of Carnival? What do I got to do?
The concert. You gotta go to the concert.
You stole my answer.
I'm drowning.
I'm drowning. We're so wise in water. Why is she like been underground in water? Okay, guys, I'm really excited for that.
Awesome.
How about you, Diva?
Okay, also an AB shout out activities board. I am so excited to see Amelia de Moldenberg. You have to go to the speaker show.
Chicken shop day.
Awesome. Yeah. So
remember to follow us on Instagram at CMU Booked and reach out to us, any of us, if you want to be a guest.
I will only be receiving requests to be on the pod via letter, and it has to be a good letter.
Oh yeah, don't sell me some, you know, don't give me some Mr. Martin first proposal bullshit. Give me that revised. Give me that revision.
Period.
Okay, bye everyone.
Bye.